Hey everyone, this is Claire. During this recording, we break down the makeup of a great customer interview. Even though we cover a lot of ground in this episode, we know that doing this kind of work internally can be daunting. So if you have a listen and you still got any questions, send me or Gia a quick message on LinkedIn or at us@forgetthefunnel.com. Okay, let's get into it. What I have experienced and the way that you and I have honed our process over time is that when you're looking for insight to make strategic decisions, in most cases, not all, but in most cases, learning from your ideal customers is like the foundation. That's where you want to start. In many cases, your biggest opportunity for revenue growth is better understanding who's an ideal fit for the product you offer right now or plan to offer in the near future. And how do you reverse engineer that best fit customer's experience to find more people like that? Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Forget the Funnel podcast, where our goal is to help you as a SaaS leader finally stop guessing, understand your best customers, and drive more predictable recurring revenue. We're Gia and Claire, founders of Forget the Funnel, a product marketing and growth consultancy that helps SaaS businesses learn from their best customers, map and measure their experiences, and unlock their best levers for growth. So if you're looking to help your team make smarter decisions, this show is for you. To set the scene here, we're going to be talking about customer interviewing specifically, but before we get into the interviewing aspects, why would you go forward with customer interviewing versus some of the other methods of customer research, like running quant surveys or gathering feedback in app, like NPS or other methods of like qualitative or, you know, more quantitatively focused? Like, why interviews? Why do interviews win? In what situations do interviews win, in your opinion? What I have experienced and the way that you and I have honed our process over time is that when you're looking for insight to make strategic decisions, in most cases, not all, but in most cases, learning from your ideal customers is like the foundation. That's where you want to start. In many cases, your biggest opportunity for revenue growth is better understanding who's an ideal fit for the product you offer right now or plan to offer in the near future. And how do you reverse engineer that best fit customer's experience to find more people like that? So the foundation of research in a business context is often those ideal customers. And then everything else or every other type of research you may want to conduct would ideally be layered on top of that so that you're always grounded in who are we solving for? Who's the best fit?
So you're describing a more macro understanding of your customers and then drilling in with other research methodologies. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. There's a number of different ways we can like split this out. So there's types of research, for example, UX research, you know, like using session replay, for example, or, you know, live user sessions to observe how do people interact with the product. There is competitive analysis. So, you know, taking the temperature of the competing solutions in your space and understanding, you know, how they describe their unique value versus how you do, or what their in-app experience looks like versus what yours looks like. Those types of research are very informative, but if they're conducted without the foundation of your ideal customer and what that person cares about, it's really easy to veer off in directions that are not actually that helpful.
So we've talked about this foundational understanding of customers. There may be situations where you've got such a broad set of customers that you actually want to use maybe qualitative style surveys, right? Broader sort of spanning surveys that help narrow down the group of customers that are interview worthy, right? That you would actually want to get on a call with and run those interviews with so that you can have those deeper, more like nuanced conversations and actually start understanding at a level that you definitely wouldn't get, even with the most qualitative of surveys. Those conversations, those one-on-one conversations are definitely where you get like deep and can ask like follow-on questions and things like that. That right off the bat, I just want to acknowledge sounds time consuming. It sounds really hard. It sounds like a big ask on, you know, your customers. And so we definitely want to make sure that we're not wasting our team's time. We certainly want to make sure we're not wasting our customers' time. We want to make sure that any of this time spent is really like well invested. And I imagine a big part of that, or I know a big part of that, is actually really carefully choosing the participants for these interviews. So can you talk a little bit about the process for identifying who should you even be talking to and spending this time in these conversations with?
I think where we need to start is for the team within your org tasked with solving a particular business problem. And I'm going to use the problem of product signup to usage of a critical feature, because that was the business problem being solved in the client call that I just had. They have a not free to paid activation problem, but they have a free to critical feature activation problem right now. And so I was in an excellent discussion with the product manager over this particular feature about who to talk to. Number one, this is a product very, very large, broad, self-serve user base. So we have a wealth of people that we could be learning from. In that case, we are going to start with a survey that helps us understand a couple of key data points to weed out folks who may not be the best fit. But ultimately, from that survey, we hope to end up learning from a group of people who are, number one, they're on the paid plan. Number two, they have activated or started using this feature. And number three, they've indicated a healthy usage of it over the past couple of months. So in other words, we can tell that these are people who have embedded this particular feature within their workflow. Now, in some cases, you may be in an organization where you don't have a customer base of thousands and thousands, in which case you may not need to go the survey and then interview route, or you may be in a situation where, regardless of the size of your customer base, there's a specific segment from a demographic perspective that you know you want to prioritize. So geographic region, job title, role within an organization, even role within an account, you know, the admin on the account versus end users on the account. I say all this to say one of the easiest ways to ensure that your time is well spent is to have a discussion with your team on exactly who you really care about learning from before just casting a wide net and speaking with any particular customer you can get your hands on. There was another interesting element of this discussion with this product manager on whether there is value in learning from customers who are paying but engaged and then disengaged with that feature, mm-hmm. versus those who engaged and stayed engaged with that feature. And this is a very smart person. Like I super look forward to working on this project together. And where we led in the discussion was it's very valuable to run interviews with both types of people, but learning what good looks like, in other words, learning the behaviors and the struggle and the buying context of the people who are engaged and figuring out what worked for them is very important and should be separate from the process of learning from people who attempted to engage and then disengaged. And there's several reasons for that. We may find commonalities between those folks, but more importantly, we may learn that people in the disengaged group potentially were just poor fits in the first place, right? On the acquisition side of the house, the responsibility is to drive in new users, but that's no promise that every single user coming through the front door is a great fit. And so if you aren't really careful to make sure before you begin that you have a shared definition of what a good customer looks like, then you can accidentally fall into this trap of running interviews and spending time learning from a poor fit segment of your customer base.
This is a huge part of our process, is actually identifying the right participants for the interviews. As I look at folks talking about this topic online or, you know, on podcasts or, you know, what I've read, a lot of people sort of skip right to the interviews and like, here's our customer list, let's go. We know not all customers are created equally. And you alluded to this in your answer, and like, it's important to choose your customers really carefully because you want to basically understand what that experience is and what matters to them and all of that. So I feel like this was all leading up, all of these questions were leading up to this one, which is like, all right, so you're on an interview with one of these amazing customers. What do you do? What do you ask? How do you get to that insight that we're looking for?
If you're listening to this and you're thinking about running a high value, high impact customer research sprint, look around your team and see if anybody has that type of, you know, hard to quantify, but unfair advantage, ability to listen very actively, ability to navigate kind of unpredictability without getting flustered. I detest the term soft skills, but these are those types of skills that are going to, this is why it's both an art as much as it is a science. So if you can find someone with those hard to quantify skills, that's one way to off the bat get a lot more juice out of your interviews.
Let's talk more specifically about like what you ask. And just to tee this up a little bit, we run jobs to be done style interviews. What does that mean? And what does that mean for the questions that are asked during these interviews? Like, what are we actually digging for? And are there like specific questions that may not always be articulated in the same way from one interview to the next, but like in general terms, what are we asking?
At its core, running a jobs interview is about trying to understand why somebody switched away from something they were doing and how they made decisions about what to switch to. So that involves a number of things. Number one, it involves being able to guide someone along like a chronological timeline of a story. Someone who can help guide an interviewee along the path from tell me about life before and what that looked like to you. And tell me about the day or the moments that led to you saying, I can't do this anymore. It's a very specific and it's a learned skill. And it is learnable, but it does take practice. So questions that guide someone along a storyline is critical, but also being very conscious of whether you might be asking leading questions is important as well. So to give like a poor example of this, this happened, I want to say about a year ago. I was in a conversation with a company that had already run some jobs interviews on their customers. And we were trying to figure out like, hey, can we use your interviews as source material? Great team, limited resources, trying to DIY their way to this very, very understandable situation. And so I was like, sure, send me your folder of interview recordings. And I listened to a couple of them and it made me so sad for them because they had spent, you know, weeks building their customer list, doing the outreach, getting on the phone, rescheduling when there were no shows. And in the interviews, the team was asking questions along the lines of, you know, when you signed up, like, did you see this feature? Like, did you notice it? What did you think about this feature? And that wasn't ill-intended, right? They were trying to understand, you know, whether the features they've been prioritizing mattered in the customer experience. By placing those features in the dialogue with their customer, they're preventing themselves from learning, hey, when you got into the product, what did you notice? What happened that made you realize this was the right solution for you and that you didn't have to keep evaluating other options? Super painful.
But the other thing, the other like amazing outcome of these interviews, of course, the learning. So you can't ask leading questions because you won't actually get the answers to what you were saying. Like, what was it that convinced you to give this thing a try? Or what was it about the, you know, the experience that convinced you to keep going or whatever? The other amazing thing, other than like actually understanding what the answer to that question is, but also the voice of customer that your customer naturally provides you when they answer a question like that. And so when you feed them the name of a feature or feed them any of your internal language at all, whether intentional or not, you are inadvertently killing the VOC / voice of customer you would have otherwise been able to gather from the interview.
Right. You're putting your team's internal voice into your customer's mouth. And
that's right.
Just defeats the purpose.
Yeah, that's right. What I heard you say was, you know, trying to uncover that sort of documentary, that chronological story. We got to like what life was like before and the context and the setup. We got to like, what was that trigger moment? We got to, what was it about our solution? What about what comes after that?
So we've talked about struggle and we've talked about the moment that someone, you know, realizes that your solution versus any other is going to meet their expectations or solve the struggle they're feeling. Then the end to that story or getting to the end of that, you know, chronological order of events is understanding what they envisioned and now what they can do or what defines life being better than it was when they started searching. In our internal team language, we just call these struggle, motivation, desired outcome. I'm getting jargony with like jobs to be done terminology. But question-wise, things that we might ask a customer to get that information would be like, okay, you know, you've been using our product since X number of months. You've switched over this many months ago. So talk to me about what can you do now that you couldn't before? What's the number one thing that is better than, you know, life with your prior solution? Or I'm going to expand one step beyond that. This is a bit of an experimental question, so don't necessarily try at home or don't take too seriously. Something that we do play with is also asking, like, what do you wish our product did that it doesn't do today? And again, that's very handled with care because it's easier for people to predict what they think they would want, but not actually be compelled to purchase that thing. So again, that's not the question I would take most seriously or prioritize if you're newer to running customer research, but it can be interesting if you've done this before and you have the ability to kind of filter, I don't know, your interpretation.
Yes, you're totally right. I do love when an interview can pull something like that out, particularly because it gives the product team kind of what they wanted.
What right? They asked for.
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing that I would add is in some situations as well, it can make sense to ask like, okay, so now that this problem has been solved for you, obviously this is not exact language, but now that you've reached this better life, what is the next most hardest thing about this process for you? And I actually just had a conversation about this with Heidi yesterday. So it's very related because that also can pull out for us some of the opportunities that open up in terms of what the more customer-facing teams might be able to help customers with, even if it is not related to the development or product roadmap. So something like, you know, some sort of customer education or customer marketing that the marketing team may have an opportunity to run, or the customer support or customer success team in thinking about like, okay, once somebody reaches that like happy, healthy sort of place in their relationship with us, what can we do for them next? Like, how can we help them use the product in more sophisticated ways, expand their usage and do, you know, all those other things. So it's definitely a like, don't try this at home kind of thing, because it can be tricky for all the reasons that you already mentioned, but it kind of like the icing on, it's the cherry on top when we can get that kind of insight out of an interview as well, even though it's not necessarily fundamental to understanding that foundational understanding of our amazing customers. It's kind of the nice to have, the like the cherry on top. By the way, like I know that you have trained dozens of people on interviewing. So I know that you've seen a lot of mistakes being made. I know you've conducted a lot of interviews. You've also watched a lot of interviews conducted by others. So yeah, what would you say are some of the things to watch out for when having these conversations?
I do tend to recommend that people who are newer to this process have a set of questions at the ready, because if you're newer to running interviews and maintaining kind of control of a conversation, it can be very easy to let the customer or the interviewee kind of run away with a particular topic. Mm-hmm. And so having like a security blanket in the form of a question script can be helpful to kind of like enable you to keep guardrails on the conversation. But this is, again, like art as much as it is science. You also ideally, either you outsource them to someone who enjoys and is good at this, or you work on your ability to kind of like an improv, you know, professional, like you work on your ability to adapt those questions and not like get stuck in, you know, forcing the conversation to go down the list. But Chris Speck, who is Bob Mester's business partner at the Rewired Group for a very long time, who I got to work with directly on audiobooks as a product several years ago, Chris has this great article from it's like a Medium article from forever ago, but it talks about developing what he framed as like your nose for energy. So think about someone who is like a food critic, or think about someone who is a sommelier. Like in certain disciplines, you need to develop this hypersensitive attention to nuance and detail. And in interviewing, that's really about developing this ability to hear when somebody is getting like emotionally worked up and letting the conversation in some cases kind of go off track to hear what they are so worked up about. So a list of questions is really helpful as like, you know, your training wheels. But over time, I like if this is interesting work to you, ideally you get to the point where, you know, like a very skilled professional in those food and beverage industries, you can run an interview in a way that's more about like listening for energy versus just like following the script.
Energy, like this exact concept and an idea, is actually why interviewing will never be, I don't think, something that like AI can do. Not only in the running of interviews, but also in the like interpreting of, right now, NLPs, which basically analyze like text, right? They don't measure for energy. There is no real AI that I know of, and I've been looking into this a little bit, and also confirmed by Bob himself, that can actually measure energy in the way that like another human being would do. And so like, mm-hmm. this is very much the art of interviewing. I don't believe AI is going to be able to replace like one-on-one, like human to human interviewing anytime soon. I am seeing a lot of tools come on the market that are trying to do it. But for this exact reason, it's the difference between an interview that turns into something that your business can actually use, because that human being can like lean into the energy and dig in a way that an automated process, a way that quantitative research also can't do. And then the other thing that I was going to say originally was, we've seen many people go through this process. I mentioned already that you've trained many people on how to run jobs interviews. And anecdotally, I believe what I've heard, and you can confirm if you think this is off, somebody would need to run a couple of dozen, at least a handful of interviews before they actually feel, a handful is actually sounds too few, before they feel comfortable, like they're actually getting what they needed out of that interview. Like, you kind of botched the first, I don't know how many. It's okay to mess up. It is important to get comfortable with that and get used to like where your insecurities are so you can kind of work with that. A very helpful practice is either, you know, with your colleagues or with whoever in your professional network is willing to sit down for 20, 30 minutes, actually practicing this by asking someone about a new purchase they recently made. And that's typically how I coach people. I'll pick a software product, sometimes a consumer product, not important, but I'll pick a product and have the person I'm coaching try to uncover like where my struggle was, how I looked, how I chose a solution, and what better life I envisioned. And as a person coaching people to do this, it's helpful because I know where my energy is and I can see where they may not have the confidence to ask a follow-up question, or they may be leaning too heavily on the script. And I'm like, you just missed like tons of detail that you could have dug into. So do some mock interviews, do some interviews where you're okay with like getting feedback before you get on a call with a customer.
What advice would you provide to like founders next? Would you say, go try to do this on your own? Would you say outsource it? What sort of recommendations do you have there?
So we're at the point in our book, having been out now, that we're seeing a more consistent stream of folks coming into our ecosystem being like, hey, read your book, seems super relevant to what we're dealing with at our company right now. What do we do next? And the what do we do next being very open-ended of like, do we work with you? We kind of think we can DIY this, but we have questions. And I'll talk through some different scenarios. One scenario is that a whole team of folks, so a founder and a product manager and a marketer and a head of CS, like all read the book as like an internal book club, which, number one, amazing. And the situation they're in is that their product manager, their head of product, is actually quite interested in strengthening her interview skills. So she has a vested interest in either DIYing it or writing Sidecar and us providing guidance. So the decision that we arrived at was, because she doesn't have a background in, you know, journalism or psychology or other like research oriented professions, we made the decision for our team to run the research, but she's going to sit in silently on the calls themselves and not join the discussion, but just try to listen to where we find that energy and where we dig for follow-up questions. So if you have people on your team who really want to build these skills, having an outside team who knows what they're doing and can do it quickly, like can save your team time, is super valuable. And it's a nice double win where you get the work done and it gets done well, but also somebody internally is upskilling and then they can do that in the future.
Yeah. And it's the, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail scenario can happen a lot too. When you run these types of projects internally, where like if it's a head of marketing, the things that they're going to pull from the interviews will be very different than a product owner, for example, versus a business owner. And so a third party can also help with that as well and be that more objective party. Again, the, you know, it's hard to read the label from inside the jar kind of thing. Having that objective mm-hmm. third party can be wildly valuable in pulling out the insights that the business actually needs and not inadvertently, you know, sway to one side or the other with what's pulled out of the interviews. You know, again, it can depend on what your job title is, what problem it is you're trying to solve. And ideally in this scenario, again, just to bring it right back to the beginning of this conversation, we're looking for that foundational understanding of your customers so that you can make mission critical, like business decisions about how to grow, how to position and message your product in the market. And if the lens through which your interviews are interpreted is like somebody with a marketing hat, the learnings that are going to come out of that are going to be much more market focused, audience side, acquisition side of things versus somebody with a product manager, product owner hat, which is going to pull more that like feature product side of things post acquisition. Both wildly valuable, but there is just the risk that you're slanting the insights one way or the other, which is obviously like a huge missed opportunity and a risk depending on like, you know, what your business is challenged with right now. So it can be very helpful to have an objective third party.
That idea of having an objective third party should not be considered a knock at anyone's team. We seek outside input on how we're running things, right? Like everyone in charge of making critical decisions can benefit from having an outside neutral third party weigh in.
And that's it for this episode of the Forget the Funnel podcast. Thanks for tuning in. If you have any questions about the topics we covered, don't hesitate to contact Claire or I on LinkedIn. And you can also visit our website at forgetthefunnel.com. This is still a new podcast for us, so ratings, reviews, and subscriptions in your podcast platform of choice make a huge difference. See you next time.